Welcome, everybody, to the Brains Bible Institute. I'm Pastor Tim Warner, your teacher. We're in module number 11, going through the book of Revelation. This is lesson number 24. Now, we are in the section that deals with the seven trumpets in Revelation. Last time, we went over the fifth and sixth trumpet judgments, which were referred to as woes. The last three trumpets, number 5, 6, and 7, are referred to as woes. I commented last time that this emphasizes the fact that these last three judgments are much more intense and severe than the previous ones. And for that reason, among others that we mentioned last time, we place these last three in the last half of the time that we talk, that we call the time of tribulation, or Daniel's 70th week. That is, that is after the abomination of desolation. Now, also, we get to chapter 10, and chapter 10 is sandwiched, actually chapter 10 all the way through 11, chapter 11, verse 13, is an interlude in the sequence of events. You may remember that as we went through these seven seals, that beginning in chapter 7 of Revelation, there was a sort of an interlude where the narrative goes back to the beginning and explains why there's 144,000 of the tribes of Israel that must be sealed there before the judgments come. It says, "Hurt not the earth or the trees until we have sealed the servants of God in their foreheads." So clearly all the damage that was being done in the earlier seals, the first four seals, it's saying, it's sort of pausing that and saying, before all that, we have to seal the servants of God in their foreheads. So chapter 7, the first part of chapter 7 deals with this sort of an interlude or jumping back. And this takes place in between the, the sixth and seventh seal judgment. Well, we have exactly the same thing with the trumpets. Between the sixth and seventh trumpet judgment, we have this, and this, in this case, it's a even lengthier description that goes back to the beginning of the time of tribulation and explains some things prior to the seventh trumpet. So all of chapter 10 and chapter 11 verses 1 through 13 is part of this interlude, and we see that when we get to chapter 11 after this section, after verse 13, it says that, look, the second woe is past, and now second woe is past, which is the sixth trumpet, and then it talks about the coming of the seventh trumpet. Well, the sixth trumpet ended at the end of chapter 9, and so that makes it pretty clear that what follows in chapters 10 all the way through 11, 13 is this interlude or this recapping of events. Now, as we will see, the recapping of events involves John being shown a vision in chapter 10. He hears seven thunders and so forth. And then in chapter 11, that is expanded upon even further with the description of the two witnesses that are going to prophesy for the first half of the, the first half of the time of tribulation. All right, so let's pick up in chapter 10 and verse 1. I think what I'll do is I'll read all of chapter 10, and then we'll comment on it. Most likely, this lesson is going to involve all of chapter 10. We'll save the first part of chapter 11 for next time, okay? All right, verse 1. And I observed another messenger, powerful, coming down from the sky, having been clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was above his head. His face was like the sun, and his feet like pillars of fire. And in his hand was a little scroll, having been opened. And he set his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land, and called out with a loud voice as a lion roars. And when he called out, seven thunders proclaimed their sayings. And when the seven thunders spoke, I was about to write. But I heard a voice from the sky saying, quote, seal up the sayings of the seven thunders, and you should not write them. And the messenger whom I saw, having stood on the sea and on the land, raised his right hand to the sky and swore by the one living unto the ages of the ages, who created the sky, the things in it, and the land, and the things in it, and the sea, and the things in it, that there shall be time no longer. But in the days of the sounding of the seventh messenger, when he should be about to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he declared to his servants the prophets. And the voice which I heard from the sky spoke to me again, saying, go, take the little scroll, open in the hand of the messenger standing on the sea and on the land. And I went to the messenger, asking him to give me the little scroll. And he says to me, take and eat it. It will make your stomach bitter, but in your mouth it will be sweet as honey. And I took the little scroll from the hand of the messenger and ate it. And it was as sweet as honey in my mouth. And when I had eaten it, my stomach was bitter. And they said to me, it is necessary for you to prophesy again against many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. All right, now, we first need to decide who this messenger is. In verse 1, he says, I observed another messenger. Now, the reason it says another is because he is distinct from the seven messengers or angels who have the seven trumpets that are blowing the seven trumpets. So he's distinct from them. You may notice in my translation, I've capitalized messenger, and there's a good reason for that. You may remember in chapter 1 of Revelation, Jesus himself is called God's messenger. And he is the ultimate messenger. He is the messenger of the Lord all throughout the Old Testament, who appeared to men like Abraham and to Moses at the burning bush and so forth. So anyway, it says, I observed another messenger, powerful, coming down from the sky. And now it says, clothed with a cloud. Now, it's interesting that John records a lot of descriptive material about this other messenger who's coming down. And all of the things that he describes are identifiers that this refers to Christ, because all of these things are applied to Christ in other previous scripture. All right, so let's look at some of those so we're clear. It says in the first criteria was that he is clothed with a cloud. Now, what does that mean, clothed with a cloud? Well, actually, there's a couple of things in this, in his description here, that point us back to the experience or the vision that John, along with Peter and James, had on the Mount of Transfiguration. I want to look at that. Let's go to Matthew chapter 17. Pardon me. In chapter 17, verse 1, it says, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, that is the writer of Revelation, led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun. His clothes became as white as the light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, look, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, let us make here three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And while he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. That is, they were engulfed in this bright cloud. And suddenly a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved Son, whom I am well pleased. Hear him. So Christ and his disciples, the three disciples, were engulfed in this cloud when that occurred. Now, it says here that in chapter 10, verse 1 of Revelation, it says, having been clothed with the cloud. Well, when was he clothed with the cloud? It was at the Mount of Transfiguration. And it says a rainbow was above his head. A rainbow above his head. Now, this is referring to Ezekiel chapter 1. If you flip back there for just a moment. In Ezekiel, Ezekiel was given a vision of God's throne, but the one seated on the throne was the Son of Man, not the Father. Let's look at verses, Ezekiel chapter 1, verse, 26 through 28. It says, "And above the firmament, over their heads," this is the heads of the four living creatures, "the likeness of a throne in appearance like a sapphire stone. On the likeness of the throne was the likeness of the appearance of a man." All right, not God the Father, but the appearance of a man on this throne. "Also, from the appearance of his waist and upward, I saw, as it were, the color of amber, with the appearance of fire all around within it." So we've got the fire there as well, as we'll see here in a minute. "From the appearance of his waist and downward, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire and brightness all around, like the appearance of a rain," excuse me, "of a rainbow." And again, we have the rainbow being mentioned here in Revelation 10. "In the cloud on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the brightness all around, and it was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. So when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard a voice of one speaking," and so forth. Now this is, if you continue reading in chapter 2, this is when God called Ezekiel to be his prophet, to be his mouthpiece, to speak to the nation of Israel, to explain why he was sending his judgments upon them by bringing Nebuchadnezzar to destroy Jerusalem and the temple and to take some of his people captive. But he was, Ezekiel was a prophet that was called by God at this time, and he was being called to pronounce, to explain why God's judgment was coming on Israel, but also that God was going to judge the surrounding nations, including Babylon, by the way, that God used to judge Israel. So the judgment is of both Israel and the nations, the surrounding nations. In Ezekiel's prophecy. So that was when God called Ezekiel. He appeared to Ezekiel in this way, with the rainbow, the fiery appearance, and all that kind of stuff. All right, so back in chapter 10 of Revelation, it says, "And a rainbow was above his head. His face was like the sun." Now, where is that coming from? Well, if you go back to the Mount of Transfiguration that we just looked at in Matthew 17, look what it says in verse 2. It says, "He was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as the light." All right, so the face bright as the sun is taken directly from the Mount of Transfiguration. Back to Revelation, it says, "And his feet like pillars of fire." Well, where does that come from? Well, back in Revelation chapter 1, we have that description of Christ himself. If we, let's just flip back to verse 15. It says, excuse me one second. "His feet were like white brass, as if having been molten in a furnace, and his voice like the sound of many waters." All right, so we see that the fiery feet and legs portrayed as being Christ there. Now, back to chapter 10, verse 2, it says, "And in his hand was a little scroll having been opened." Now, we'll get back to the little scroll in a moment when it's brought up again further down. And he set his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land. Now, these are important details. Now, why is the right foot on the sea and the left foot on the land? Well, if you follow through the book of Revelation as these visions unfold in the later chapters, you'll see that the land is a representation of God's land. That is, it's the land that God promised to Abraham, but it has been taken over and polluted by all these, well, by Israel, but also by all these Gentile nations and so forth. In fact, back in Joel chapter 3, God's judgment upon the surrounding nations was because of what they did to his land. All right, so the land in Revelation is primarily not, you know, it's translated the earth in most translations. And so when people read that, they think, well, this, It's talking about those who dwell in the land, that it must be talking about, you know, everybody who lives on planet Earth. No, it's not talking about that. It's talking about those who have been dwelling on the land that God promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, what does the sea represent? Because it says he has one foot on the land and one foot on the sea. Well, the sea represents the nations, the Gentiles. And we see this in Revelation 13, where the beast, the Antichrist kingdom, comes up out of the sea. John says, I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw this, you know, seven-headed beast coming up out of the sea. Why is it coming up out of the sea? Well, it's the Mediterranean Sea, but the Mediterranean Sea was the place where all the ships came from all the Gentile nations, like, you know, the ships of Rome and the ships of Cyprus and the ships of Egypt and all that stuff came from the sea, because they were all these foreign nations and they would trade with Israel, or they would, you know, make war with Israel and so forth. And so anyway, the sea, the Mediterranean Sea especially, was a representation of all these surrounding Gentile nations. And so when you have this messenger who is Christ being portrayed as putting one foot on the Mediterranean Sea and one foot on the land, it means one foot upon the kingdoms of the nations, the Gentiles, and one foot upon the Holy Land, the land of Israel. And the fact that his feet are like pillars of fire, and he's placing one on the Gentile nations and one on the nation of Israel, shows that God is bringing his judgment and his trial by fire, if you will, his purging, upon both the nation of Israel, upon his Holy Land, and upon those who have corrupted his land and so forth, and also on all these surrounding nations, right? So it's that whole Mediterranean area. Excuse me. All right, now let's look at the fact. It says that he had the voice like a lion. Look at verse 3. It says, he called out with a loud voice as a lion roars. Now, again, every detail is important. Why is he called, is this messenger, why is his voice like a lion roaring? Well, this is being drawn out of Hosea. So let's take our Bibles and go to Hosea chapter 5. Hosea chapter 5, and we're going to see three times that Christ is likened to a lion in Hosea. First, Hosea 5 verse 14. He says, for I will be like a lion to Ephraim and like a young lion to the house of Judah. I, even I, will tear them and go away. I will take them away and no one shall rescue. I will return again to my place until they acknowledge their offense. Then they will seek my face in their affliction and they will earnestly seek me. Now, this is a prophecy of Christ when he announced in the Gospels that he was going to go away, and where he was going, they could not follow him. And they said, what, is he going to kill himself and all this stuff? You know, they didn't understand what he's talking about. But here he's saying he's going to go away and he is going to return to his place and he's going to tear them like a lion. Now, that what was the tearing like a lion? Well, that's when the Roman armies, God sent the Roman armies to destroy Jerusalem the second time. And so forth. And then we see that beginning in the next chapter, it talks about the end times when the 144,000 are sealed and all that. It says, come, let us return to the Lord, that is Israel. For he has torn, but he will heal us. He has stricken, but he will bind us up. This is after the second exile by the Romans has run its course. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up that we may live in his sight. And that's the resurrection there, and it's the restoring of Israel to fulfill the promises that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right, so we see that he is when he goes away, he acts against Israel like a lion by sending the Roman armies and sending them into exile the second time. Well, if you go over to Hosea chapter 11 now, just a few more pages. verse 10, it says, I think I might have the wrong reference. Oh, no, I'm right. Hosea 11, verse 10. They will walk after the Lord. He will roar like a lion. When he roars, then his sons shall come trembling from the west. And again, this is that is talking about the time of tribulation as well. Now, go over to chapter 13 of Hosea. And this one is really interesting, I think. 13, verse 7. So I will be to them like a lion, like a leopard by the road I will lurk. I will meet them like a bear deprived of her cubs. I will tear open their rib cage, and I will devour many like a lion. The wild beast shall tear them. Okay, so three times in the book of Hosea, we have the Lord, which in this case is Christ, because this is applied to Christ in the Gospels. When he says, I'm going to go away and return to my place until they acknowledge me. In fact, Jesus said that specifically in Matthew 23, at the end of Matthew 23, when he said that your house is left to you desolate, and you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. All right, that's the acknowledgement when they return to God, and they say, you know, after 2 days, he's going to raise us up. That's the 2,000 years from the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. All right, anyway, so that's the reason why his voice is like a lion here. let's continue reading in back in Revelation chapter 10. Let's see, where was I? Okay, it says, verse 3, it says, and he called out with a loud voice, as a lion roars. And when he called out, seven thunders proclaimed their sayings. And when the seven thunders spoke, I was about to write. But I heard a voice from the sky saying, seal up the sayings of the seven thunders, and you should not write them. Now, this is interesting because the book of Revelation is a revealing, right? And so John was given a special revelation. There was, I mean, we've got seven seals, we've got seven trumpets. Later we have seven bowls of wrath in chapter 16. And there are also seven thunders who speak. But John was the only one who heard what they said. So John was privy to that particular revelation, but that revelation was not written down. It was not sent to the seven assemblies. And so John did not reveal to anyone what the seven thunders said. Well, why? I mean, what would be the purpose of God giving John, you know, the revelation about these seven thunders and what they had to say about the end times if he wasn't going to use that information to inform the seven assemblies that he's writing to? Well, the reason for that is shown just a little bit later, and that is John is going to be resurrected from the dead in order to prophesy during the last, or during the time of tribulation. Actually, it's the first half of that 70th week. Now, we'll learn a lot more about that in next week's lesson when we talk about the two prophets or two witnesses in chapter 11. But he's told here in this chapter, as we'll see in a moment, that he is going to be prophesying again. And it is after the book of Revelation. He's going to have a role as a prophet. All right, anyway, let's continue reading. It says, let's go to verse 5 now. And the message, oh, by the way, the seven thunders were messages directly for John so that he will then give out that information when he is one of the two prophets in the end times. All right, so the content of the seven thunders will be revealed by John to those living at the time, during that time of tribulation. All right, verse 5. And the messenger whom I saw, having stood on the sea and on the land, raised his right hand to the sky and swore by the one living unto the ages of the ages, who created the sky and the things in it, and the land and the things in it, and the sea and the things in it, That is, God created everything. I want you to notice something about this statement. He says, who created the sky, the land, and the sea? And when we think of creation, you know, most people have a kind of a modern mindset, a scientific kind of a mindset. They think of Earth as being a planet hurtling through space that has its own complete ecosystem, which includes the atmosphere and the seas and all the life and things that are happening. And so when you refer to the Earth, in modern speech, we're referring to the whole planet and its entire, all of its systems contained in that. But that's not how the Bible uses terminology. All right. And in the first chapter of the Bible, in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, God defines the terms. It says that when he created the heavens and the earth, he called the sky, or the firmament, which was the place that separated the waters above from the waters below. The waters below are the oceans and all the, you know, water that's lakes and so forth. The waters above were the clouds. And so what is the firmament that is between the waters above, that is the clouds, and the waters below, that is the oceans and seas? Well, it's that expanse where the birds fly. So it says God called that firmament heaven. And then it says the dry land he called earth. And then it said, the waters he called seas. So in the Bible, the perspective is that there are three components. There is the dry land, there are the seas, and then there is the space in between the clouds and the land, which is, he calls the firmament, which is called heaven. And that's where the birds fly. All right, birds fly in the heavens. They don't fly above the clouds. They fly in the heavens. Right now, there is heavens beyond that as well. Paul talks about the third heaven, which is where God dwells. And it's the perspective of mankind. I mean, the Bible is written from a human perspective, that is, from an observational perspective. And so, you know, looking up in the sky, we see the immediate heavens, which is where the birds fly. And then we see that there's something even beyond the clouds, which is the sun and the moon and the stars. So that is the second heaven, the heaven beyond the local heavens. And then there is that heaven even beyond, that is what is not observable to the human eye. All right. And that is where God dwells. Now, he's not, when the Bible uses that kind of terminology, it's not using it in a scientific way. It's not like if you leave the earth and travel, you know, in a rocket, and you get up above the clouds, now you're in the second heaven. And now if you keep going and you go beyond what we can see in the sky, the sun, the moon, and the stars, if you keep going, you'll eventually pass into the place where God dwells. Because that's a misconception, because God's dwelling is not part of this creation. All right, it's something apart from the creation. So it's not like it's a location beyond that. But when the Bible is written, it's written from the perspective of how humans would view things. All right, God speaks to us in a way that we can understand. Now, you might say, well, I can understand, galaxies and all this stuff. Yeah, but the Bible wasn't written to you. See, the Bible was written to these primitive people. And it was written using language that they could comprehend based on their society and, you know, what was common knowledge or how people thought about the creation and so forth. And so it writes to them in a way that, you know, on a level that they can understand. All right. So anyway, my point is simply that as we progress through the book of Revelation, and we will see quite a few times where it talks about the land and the sky and the seas, that it's the whole creation is broken down into these three components because that is man's perspective, or it was man's perspective at the time that the book of Revelation was written. Okay, so just so you don't have any confusion about that. All right, anyway, he says, let's go back to verse 5. The messenger whom I saw, having stood on the sea and on the land, raised his right hand to the sky and swore by the one living unto the ages of the ages, who created all this stuff. Now, when God swears something, and this is Christ, he's swearing something, you need to pay attention, all right? You may remember in the book of Hebrews, we went through Hebrews that in chapter 6, that there was a big deal made about the oath that God swore to Abraham. And it's he refers to the original promise that he gave Abraham, and then it refers to the oath that God swore when Abraham was willing to offer up his son Isaac in Genesis 22. And it says that by these two immutable things or unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie. So the point is that whenever God swears an oath, it is that this is 100% certain. Nothing can change it. God cannot change it. He will not, because his reputation depends on it. And so when he swears, it's really, really important. Well, what does he swear here? That is the messenger who is the Son of God. What does he swear? Let's look at it again. Verse 5, the messenger whom I saw, having stood on the sea and on the land, again, representing judgment upon the nations and upon Israel, raised his right hand to the sky. Again, he's swearing an oath, so he's raising his hand. And swore by the one living unto the ages of the ages, that is by the Father, who created all these things, that there shall be time no longer. Now that's a statement that is confusing to a lot of people. There shall be time no longer. What does that mean? Well, some translations say there will be no more delay. That is that the, you know, what's going to happen after this will happen soon. No, there's no more delay. But that's not what it says. There is a word for delay in the Greek, but that's not the word that's used here. All right, it's literally the word for time, chronos. In Greek. So there shall be time, chronos, no longer. Now other people think, okay, well this means that that eternity begins now. But eternity is still time. All right, just because it's unending doesn't mean it's not time. You know, years will pass. I mean, the millennium, the 1,000 years is going to pass. That's time, right? So what does he mean by there shall be time no longer? Well, he's referring to that set time that God has set aside for the curse to run its course. See, when Adam and Eve sinned in the Garden of Eden, God cursed the ground and he cursed mankind and he pronounced death upon the whole human race. He told Adam, dust you are, into dust you shall return. But he set a limit on that curse. And that limit is given in Genesis, I believe it's chapter 9, where he talks about that the days, man's days, that is referring to under the curse, will be 120 years. And people don't understand what that means, but the years he's referring to there are those Jubilee years of 50-year cycles. And so there, that if you figure that out, 50 times 120, it's 6,000 years. And also the ages of mankind have been divided into 6 millennia. We see this, actually it's 7 millennia, but the 7th is the kingdom, the rest. It's when the curse is removed from the earth. We see this in Hebrews chapter 4, where it talks about the kingdom, Christ's kingdom, his reign, being the Sabbath rest. It proves that it's the Sabbath. It calls the kingdom the seventh day. Well, if the kingdom is the seventh day, then that means that 6 days preceded it. And since we know that the kingdom is 1,000 years, according to Revelation 20, then that day is 1,000 years, and I mean, 2 Peter 2, Psalm 90, verse 4, say that a day with God is 1,000 years. And so those 6,000 years, those 6 days corresponding with the 6 days that man must labor, corresponds to man's time allotted under the curse. It's the sentence. It's the time of the sentence of all of humanity to be under the curse, 6,000 years. Well, that's the time that expires when the seventh trumpet sounds. And as we'll see later in the end of chapter 11, the seventh trumpet is the second coming of Christ and the establishment of the kingdom on the earth. And so that's why that time, that allotted time for man to suffer under the curse, ends. And that's what this statement is referring to when he says that he swears, that is this messenger, who is Christ, raises his right hand to God and swears that when there will be time no longer. Okay? That is the sentence of man under the curse, no longer. But, verse 7, but in the days of the sounding of the seventh messenger, when he should be about to sound, the mystery of God should be finished. So this tells us what this time no longer means. Okay, God is portrayed throughout the Bible, but it's in some sort of a mystery, right? And but it's going to be completely revealed in the kingdom, because God's Son is going to be given full authority to reign. And you know, you'll be able to talk to him face to face. You'll be able to ask him questions about his Father. I mean, there's so much that's going to be revealed in the kingdom over that 1,000-year period. All right, so anyway, he said the mystery of God would be finished as he declared to his servants, the prophets. And what did the prophets declare over and over and over and over again? It was that the Lord is coming back to reign. Right? That's the theme of most of the prophets. They have intertwined in their, you know, local prophecies, contemporary events. But the objective of all the prophets ultimately is the coming of the kingdom of the Messiah, when Christ himself will reign upon the earth. All right, verse 8. And the voice which I heard from the sky spoke to me again, saying, go take the little scroll open in the hand of the messenger standing on the sea and on the land. And I went to the messenger, asking him to give me the little scroll. And he says to me, take and eat it. It will make your stomach bitter, but your mouth will be sweet as honey. Now, what is this little scroll? Well, the reason this vision is portrayed as Christ handing a little scroll to John, and he's supposed to eat the little scroll, is because it's referencing Ezekiel again. All right, so let's take our Bibles and go to Ezekiel chapter 1 again. We read verses 25, I think it was, through 28, where he sees the vision of the Son of God coming to him on this throne. And then in beginning of chapter 2, it says, and he said to me, son of man, stand on your feet, and I will speak to you. This is the one that appeared as a man seated upon this throne with a rainbow around him and all that stuff. Same kind of description we have here of this messenger in Revelation chapter 10. Then he says, the Spirit entered me when he spoke to me and set me on my feet, and I heard him who spoke to me, and he said to me, son of man, I am sending you to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me to this very day. For they are, let me just skip down to verse 9. All right, I have time to read all this. Now when I looked, there was a hand stretched out to me, and behold, a scroll of a book was in it. Then he spread it before me, and there was a writing on the inside and the outside, and written on it were lamentations, mourning, and woe. Now notice the word woes there. Again, that's calamity and catastrophe. All right, notice also that it was written on the outside and on the inside. That is, it's written on both sides. This is rare. Scrolls were not typically written on both sides. They were only written on one side. And when you see a scroll written on two sides, you should pay attention. Well, guess what? The scroll of the seven seals was written on both sides as well. All right? So, why is the scroll that we saw earlier of the six seals, whom the Son of Man is going to open each seal, and when he opens each seal, these plagues, you know, the four horsemen and all that stuff, those things ensue. Why is that scroll, and it's the same scroll, why is that scroll now being given to John? Well, it's because John is going to be one of the two witnesses on the earth. So while the Lamb is in heaven opening the seals of the scroll, John, along with Elijah, who's the other witness, we'll talk more about that next time, is going to be pronouncing judgments on the earth. That is, what John and Elijah are doing on the earth corresponds to what the Lamb is doing in heaven when he's opening the seals. All right, so the judgments pour forth because these two prophets are going to speak judgment, and those judgments are going to happen. Again, we'll see more of that next time. All right. Moreover, he said to me, Son of man, eat what you find. Eat this scroll and go speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he caused me to eat that scroll. And he said to me, Son of man, feed your belly and fill your stomach with this scroll that I give you. So I ate, and it was in my stomach like honey and sweetness. Then he said to me, Son of man, go to the house of Israel and speak my words to them. For you are not sent to a people of unfamiliar speech and of hard language, but to the house of Israel. Not to many people of unfamiliar speech and hard language, whose words you cannot understand. Surely I have sent you to them. They would have listened to you. But to the house of Israel will not listen to you, because they will not listen to me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hardened. And so forth. So this passage is all about Ezekiel telling us how God called him to be his prophet to Israel at the time that God was sending Nebuchadnezzar to bring God's wrath upon the nation of Israel. And so, Ezekiel is being called to be this prophet, to be warning. Well, then the same thing is happening to John. He's being called to be God's prophet. He's the one whom God says, go take the scroll and eat it. And it's going to be bitter, sweet in your mouth and bitter in your stomach. It's sweet because it is a sweet thing to be used by God as his tool. It's bitter because the message is bitter. All right, and so that's the same thing with regard to Ezekiel is happening with regard to John. And now he's given the interpretation of this in verse 10 of chapter 10 of Revelation. It says, I took the little scroll from the hand of the messenger and ate it, and it was as sweet as honey in my mouth. And when I had eaten, my stomach was bitter. Now, this is clearly a reference to Ezekiel chapter 3. Verse 11. And they said to me, now who is they? Well, they is the voice was from heaven that commanded John, which was the Father, commanding John to go take the scroll, and also the messenger himself. So there's two voices here. They said to me, quote, it is necessary for you to prophesy again. That is in addition to the book of Revelation. Against many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. So the interpretation of all of this in chapter 10, all of this, the messenger coming down from heaven, it's all about John being called and told that he's going to have to prophesy again. In addition to what he's writing down here in the book of Revelation, he's going to have to play the role that Ezekiel played back at the time of the Babylonian exile, that John himself is going to play that role in the end times as God's prophet, pronouncing judgments. And notice it's not just that he's writing to the seven assemblies. No, it's that he is going to prophesy again against many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. as we get into chapter 11 next week, you're going to see that that is exactly what one of the two prophets does. All right? All right, so we'll... Okay, there's my alarm. We'll end with that, and next time we'll pick up with chapter 11. All right? God bless you all, and it's been a pleasure.